Save big this holiday season. All in the Kroger app.
Buy two, get three free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up. Then get a flavorful Kroger spiral sliced ham for 89 cents a pound with an additional $25 purchase. Limit two, all with your card.
Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Ultra-processed foods high in seed oils could be fueling colon cancer risk.
And in a intricately related note, colon cancer rates have skyrocketed in those under 50. So this engages more of the population to be afraid rather than just those who are actually at high risk of colon cancer.
There's a very interesting study making rounds on social media that associates seed oils and causing colon cancer, as you can see from this clickbait headline. And this study is actually quite good, but we will discuss what this actually says and a clinical takeaway from our still biased, but maybe less biased standpoint. Welcome back to the Gillette Health Podcast, where we give you tools to develop a balanced approach for health. I'm Dr. Kyle Gillette.
And I'm James O'Hara, nurse practitioner. As you might have guessed from our intro, today we're talking about seed oils again. So were we wrong about seed oils is the first question, because we gave them a sort of neutral rating, but they are in a lot of things and people overconsume calories in general and omega-6s in general, I think was our general take on the last time. But now I saw in the last week dozens of headlines and health influencers claiming that seed oils are driving an epidemic of colon cancer. So we took a look at the data.
Yeah. And basically the data says the data does not matter because RFK is going to ban all of these seed oils anyway. There will be no seed oil. Wait a second. All omega-6s are going to be banned somehow, even though that's not really possible. But in all seriousness, maybe we should change the title to "We Were Wrong About Seed Oils?" question mark. Because that's what a lot of these influencers are doing. We were wrong about seed oils, exclamation point, question mark.
Yeah, I like that. We can do that and see how it goes. We'll see what the numbers tell us. We'll follow the data, see what the algorithm says. But did the study actually mention seed oils at all?
Not really. It mentioned omega-6 to omega-3 ratios. It mentioned lots of different types of lipids. And they did come up with a couple different interesting conclusions, which we'll get into. But the title, including our title, I guess, is completely clickbait, which is frustrating because it's not really what the study says. It was actually an excellent study done out of University of South Florida, where we have many good friends. They do a lot of good research and they push nutrition and metabolic therapies. Shout out to our metabolic health initiative, CME, of course. And it was funded by, I think, the Tampa General Hospital as well. So I suppose it was funded by big academia, but this is really one of the most independent, unbiased academic institutions in our experience. But the takeaway from this study is not necessarily you should or shouldn't consume seed oils.
And the line, I think this is the main line or the takeaway point the authors said, is that diets low in fiber and high in omega-6, basically the standard American diet,
yes,
may contribute to this. They don't say anything definitively because, as we'll talk about, there's a lot of things that can influence, if I put it this way, intracellular arachidonic acid production.
Yes.
Intracellular arachidonic acid metabolism. But that was interesting to me because the same wellness influencers that are anti-seed oil also tend to be anti-fiber. And they'll say things like, well, the fiber increases the risk of IBS, and they'll make some of these claims and cherry pick studies, but they're not saying, hey, it looks like maybe, yes, we don't want too much omega-6, but if you increase fiber in your diet, you're going to reduce your risk of colon cancer. No one has had that messaging that I'm aware of. At least I haven't read it.
Yeah. So that's some good clinical takeaways from a high level. The study itself looked at samples of human colorectal cancer, so colon cancer, and they did two different types of analyses and then looked at the expression or overexpression of the different genes that made these different inflammatory compounds like arachidonic acid. And you think about things like aspirin, which there's some evidence that it can help prevent colon cancer in some populations that work on the same arachidonic acid system. People have heard of cyclooxygenase, like COX, and we'll talk about that a little bit as well. And people have also heard of NSAIDs, and there's actually some evidence that maybe NSAIDs also work on the same pathway to help prevent colon cancer. But the takeaway shouldn't be everyone needs to take 800 milligrams of ibuprofen three times a day.
Right, 800 milligrams of aspirin every day. No, that's a joke. Go ahead and ding the sarcasm.
That's a good one. A couple terms that are important at this, because if a layman reads this, there's a lot of technical jargon. Concept of lipid class switching is basically the concept of the genetics of a cell as it heals, and they call this normal or physiologic lipid class switching, can be benefited by this a little bit of inflammatory response if you're trying to heal from a wound, or indeed if you are trying to heal from muscle protein degradation during training. In fact, these same things, the same process of PGE2 and PGD2, which are two of the molecules that are involved in this lipid class switching, are important to prevent sarcopenia, which is muscle wasting in age. So it's not really a case of it's all bad or it's all good. I really liked the proposed physiologic and then, I guess it's still physiologic, but it's just a pathologic response.
Yeah, it's interesting. And in the sort of analogy, well, we talked pre-filming that arachidonic acid is not 100% inflammatory. Arachidonic acid in the right context can actually be metabolized into pro-resolving mediators. So you have this sort of transient period of inflammation, which your body needs to get things done. Like post-exercise, you're going to have inflammation. I can sort of liken it to being awake and being asleep. When you're awake, you're going to get things done, and then you need to shift to a less inflammatory state, like sleeping, to like repair things, finish the healing process. But you need both states and the ability to switch. You can't just be awake 24 hours a day every day. You can't just sleep 24 hours a day every day.
Yeah.
Neither one works. And there's a paper that just popped into my mind where they used a shot of like dexamethasone and actually ended up with stronger Achilles tendons if they gave it at the right time during an injury. Not for humans, so don't do this, but in rats. So when they were able to attenuate the inflammation at a specific time point in an extremely controlled environment, which is why I said don't do this if you're a human, then they were actually able to double the strength of the Achilles. So they're able to actually switch to anti-inflammatory at a precise moment in time and get that outcome. So we can't control those switches precisely, but in a laboratory setting, if we're fast-forwarding medicine 10 or 20 years, maybe that's something that is possible.
Mm-hmm. So some of the takeaways from this study is in the colon cancer tumors, the arachidonic acid derivatives were overexpressed, the genes were too active, and the receptors were too active. It reminds us a lot of a huge amount of data, of which we will post the links to the studies in the description, on VEGF and colon cancer, another super important thing for colon cancer. But of course, the takeaway with VEGF and colon cancer is not that everyone should be on Avastin, which is a VEGF inhibitor, and nobody should ever take BPC-157. And VEGF is always bad because it is extremely closely correlated with colon cancer growth and survival, indeed, of people that have colon cancer, because it has benefits too.
Yeah, your body's essentially going to fall apart if your VEGF activity goes to zero. So you don't want that. It's sort of like this appropriate switching and like these checkpoints that are built in. And when the cellular machinery and these checkpoints go awry, you run into problems. So even something like exercise increases VEGF mRNA expression in the muscle. Mm-hmm. Right? That's an adaptive response. You want better muscle capillarization. You don't want zero VEGF activity.
Yeah. So the, I guess, homeostasis of these overexpressed arachidonic acid pathways. Another analogy I thought of is you don't want this to be, you know, active 24 hours a day, just like you said. You also don't want to be having bowel movements 24 hours a day. If you look at the correlation between people who poop their pants very frequently, they have infections all the time.
It's like C. diff.
Yeah. I mean, it's true. So you want to have it a normal adaptive amount of time. You don't want to never have a bowel movement. But you want to make sure that when you do, the inflammatory material is excreted. So rather than look at what the inputs are, which yes, arachidonic acid, of course, is can be synthesized from seed oils. There's also endogenous inputs. Endocannabinoids can be synthesized into arachidonic acid. That's in called endogenous synthesis. That's what the body makes itself, not something that we're actually consuming. And the enzyme that metabolizes these PDE and PGD2 enzymes is also very important. In fact, it's been studied quite a bit for arachidonic acid metabolism in muscle. That's 15-PGDH. And if this is really high, then you're going to metabolize it too fast. So that is associated with poor responses to muscle building, and is probably associated with poor responses to taking care of these compounds in the gut as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. And there's sort of, well, the way I'm reading it, like, what is the solution to this, or what are they trying to pitch as? Usually there's an idea of like, hey, our research is building on previous research, and here's what we think the next step should be. Mm-hmm. They're talking about sort of shortcutting around this switch, because you can, you know, presumably take pro-resolving mediators as a supplement. And
there's saying, a lot of supplement companies, if you Google that.
Studied. Yeah. And that would be interesting if they would have had, let's say, incubated these colorectal cancer tissues with, say, some fatty acid that's a pro-resolving mediator,
yeah, you know,
some metabolite of EPA. Clinically, I don't think the benefits have been much more substantial than just taking omega-3 supplementation.
Yeah.
From my read of like what is useful for my patients or myself. But maybe it's a future direction for research is what they're trying to point to. And then I don't think, there's a comment about diet, like, hey, yeah, if we had more fiber and less omega-3s, or less omega-6s rather, we probably would see less cases of colon cancer. Like, that's probably a positive, you know, dietary recommendation to make for people is eat generally like less omega-6s and generally more fiber. Mm-hmm. So there's kind of like some takeaways there. But yeah, I'm a little skeptical on how potent the currently existing pro-resolving mediators are.
Yeah, if you look at the supplements that are, you know, a lot of brands have a pro-resolving mediator supplement, it usually comes from one specific source. So it kind of reminds me of the resveratrol craze, 10 years ago now, where the data, you know, in vitro and even in animals on resveratrol and similar adaptogenic or senolytic or antioxidant molecules looked fantastic. But it does appear that it's, you know, it's good polyphenol, but it's just another polyphenol. Whereas these pro-resolving mediators come from many different sources. And if you look at, say, Boswellia or a supplement that makes some of the pro-resolving mediators, that's just one of the types. Whereas if you look at, there's multiple different types. So you're going to be taking a huge stack of pills where you could use that resources and time and whatnot to make a dietary intervention, which might be just as helpful. Now, I do think in certain populations, it's certainly reasonable to take pro-resolving mediators, but I don't think that every man, woman, and child on a semi-typical American diet should necessarily be on them, because there is potential harms to supplements like that as well.
Well, it's worth talking about, like, if you look at like what functional medicine used to be and talking about a root cause. The root cause is sort of a switch issue and then a imbalance, right? If we're talking about like the fiber and the omega-6s, right? Those are two things people can adjust.
Yep.
Clean up the diet is sort of a root cause of, at least, you know, there's a lot of studies that support like higher intakes of ultra-processed foods, lower fiber intakes with colon cancer. That's well established. I don't think people are going to argue about that. A couple of them always will.
Yeah.
But who is your, I guess if you're building an avatar for who might benefit from a pro-resolving mediator, just because that's a question somebody's going to have when they hear like certain populations, like we're not talking about like 80% of people.
Correct.
But who's your avatar for like this person may benefit from a pro-resolving mediator?
High risk of colon cancer and actually inflammatory arthritis. If you look at Aruduvaic medicine, I think they've used Boswellia and inflammatory arthritis for a really long time. And, you know, I guess you could argue they haven't done a ton of randomized placebo-controlled double-blind trials. But Aruduvaic medicine has given us some really interesting interventions. So I think that that's a pro-resolving mediator that's interesting for people that maybe have TNF-alpha overexpressed, given that things like overfeeding certainly increase TNF-alpha, and that increases the synthesis of arachidonic acid significantly. So,
and this is talking about in the cell, in the tissue. So
yeah,
you could make the case that, okay, maybe, let's say someone is consuming a ton of omega-6s. I mean, odds are pretty good if these are just samples from the general population. I don't think we have any information about these people's diets.
Mm-hmm.
But if you think, okay, so they're probably eating like most Americans are. They probably took in a lot of omega-6s. But if these were people that had just been overfeeding, regardless of the diet quality, you could potentially see also evidence that looks like a higher amount of seed oils were consumed. Because if you're only looking at the very endpoint of fatty acid metabolites, like you don't have any, you can tell all kinds of stories of how you get there. So it's like, were they just over consuming calories, but they were all clean calories?
Clean.
No, but you could see the end result look the same if you did like a, say, a tissue biopsy. It's like, oh, they were overfeeding, and now you see arachidonic acid has gone up, and the metabolites of arachidonic have gone up, and their TNF alpha has gone up. You could see these sort of bad things that happen in like overfeeding in general.
Would you rather, let's take someone with inflammatory arthritis, and maybe they have Lynch syndrome too, which is a predisposition to colorectal cancer. Would you rather have them be on an anti-inflammatory diet with very, very low seed oils, but, you know, say 20 grams of protein per day, not they're not exercising a ton. It's relatively low calorie, but they're in a caloric surplus. You know, they're eating, say, beef tallow, not to pick on something, but you're eating a lot of beef tallow. And they're adding a little bit of body fat, and they are gaining weight, as most Americans do, maybe 1 pound per year. Or would you rather take same person, but they're on an isocaloric diet, high in omega-6s, equally high in omega-3s, with a solid amount of fiber, say 45 grams per day?
What about the protein? Are they also eating 20 grams of protein in the second group?
20 grams per day.
I'm going to go with group two, not because I think that it's going to substantially change their cancer risk, but I think your quality of life and your health span are going to be much better on that dietary pattern.
I would also argue that even though the first individual is consuming a very low omega-6 diet, the ratios of omega-3 to omega-6 are the same. And in that case, I would argue the isocaloric diet at maintenance and not in a surplus is more anti-inflammatory than the anti-inflammatory diet that the first individual's on.
Yeah. Everything is anti-inflammatory until you eat too much of it.
Yes.
Some things can be anti-inflammatory until you eat too much of them.
Yes, exactly. So an anti-inflammatory diet is kind of like saying I practice anti-aging medicine.
Yeah.
It's and all about what you mean by the nomenclature.
I think this is a good segue into like Lynch syndrome, you know, genetically predisposed to colon cancer and some other cancers. But I looked at the CAPS-2 trial. That's where I pulled the figure of 600 milligrams of daily aspirin for 2 years, 40%. It's, of course, a relative reduction in colon cancer. Pretty good.
It is good.
You know, the articles that have referenced this talk about how it's an underutilized intervention in this patient population. So I think this paper tells me more about a plausible mechanism for aspirin, because the CAPS-2 trial actually cites, like, we don't know the mechanism of why this aspirin is helping, which is kind of interesting to me, because you hear people argue like, oh, it's just because you're getting more blood detection in stool and you're getting more colonoscopies and that's why. But if you're looking at, like, previously we didn't have a mechanism, and now we have, like arachidonic acid, inflammatory metabolites from arachidonic acid. Mm-hmm. And you can get a big effect size in a short period of time with aspirin,
wow,
which works directly on those blocking the metabolites of the arachidonic acid.
It's amazing.
It's sort of like turning your switch off for inflammation for you to some degree.
Yeah.
Now, it's not a cure for colon cancer. It's not going to prevent 100% of cases. I don't want to overstate it, but that was actually the most interesting implication of this paper to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Same mechanism of why aspirin would work is why these pro-resolving mediators would work, or, you know, looking at your omega-3 to omega-6 ratio, or just your genetic tendency to have more intracellular arachidonic acid in really any cell, but also colonic cells.
Yeah. And I guess I'm just a budget. I'm trying to find a budget light switch, right?
Yep.
Aspirin's a lot cheaper than a pro-resolving mediator. Mm-hmm. So if you're trying to not get colon cancer on a budget, aspirin might be a good choice.
Or let's just have the government make this choice for us. Just wait 2 months. Now, I could totally see RFK putting some legislation through in order to require all seed oil manufacturers to just put a little bit of willow bark extract in it, which, of course, is how we get aspirin, is the willow bark extract. And then there would be no downside.
So use a natural willow bark extract. But if you put a synthetic aspirin in there, that's big pharma, and he wouldn't want that, right?
Unless a compounding pharmacy made it from willow bark.
Interesting.
Yeah, it could happen. So,
I'll put that on my 2025 bingo card.
Yeah, we'll feel free to clip that reel and send it to him. One other interesting note on this is more PGE2 is not necessarily always better, and less is not necessarily always better. The authors actually agree with us. We're not critiquing the paper. The paper is actually quite good. Very well written, and it certainly had enough authors to be well written. But anyway, which I think is great that lots of people are working on this. But anyway, to get to the point, the overexpression of mast cells in the colon can lead to increased PGE2 and PGD2 levels. So does that mean if you're on mast cell stabilizers, of which there's a whole bunch of, Amlexinox, quercetin, chromalin, are these also leading to increased colon cancer risks? Because a lot of people have, you know, maybe they have bad allergies, and most cases of mast cell hypersensitivity or histamine intolerance, histamine hypersensitivity, are secondary to another condition. But are high levels of that going to drive this? Or if you're having high levels and you're trying to, you know, decrease your histaminergic potential, is overstabilization of mast cells also leading to decreased levels of these PGE2?
I mean, if you want your correlation-only social media answer, you could look at, like, when did over-the-counter antihistamine use become prevalent? And then you could see, let's say it's happened 1970, 1980. And then you could see that, looks like colon cancer rates are increasing and increasing and increasing. You could do that. And
I would see that correlation super well, but I would play devil's advocate and I would say, well, your classic antihistamines, let's say you're taking your H2 blockers or your H1, H2, H3 blockers, like Benadryl, that's just blocking the histamine receptor, right? Is that actually stabilizing the mast cell? Or would you have to look at quercetin, chromalin, maybe Amlexinox, which are more associated with actually stabilizing
the mast cell. Could actually decrease the PGE2 more. And I'm playing devil's advocate a little bit, because I'm like, hey, like, doesn't matter, because you don't have to understand the study to say scary things.
Yeah.
Or to understand the premise to say scary things. And I don't think antihistamines cause colon cancer. These medications have been out for a long time. Generally, not always, but generally you find these harmful associations, 5-10 years later, and
the takeaway has
been found with you talk about your like montelukast with like not an association with colon cancer as far as I know, but mood changes, like that's something that is now known that wasn't known initially.
It's a leukotriene B4 inhibitor, which there's a lot of discussion about leukotrienes in this paper and a lot of discussions about the inflammatory process in general, which is mostly esoteric. But another takeaway from that is mast cells are involved in the healing response in the mucosa of the GI tract, and likely in the rest of the body as well, the musculoskeletal system even. So there's a lot of things to consider, but just like we don't want to crush VEGF. So, you know, again, there's a lot of papers on how VEGF overexpression is going to lead to earlier death and much worse outcomes in colon cancer. So I would say, you know, if there's someone with Lynch syndrome or, FAP, then that's probably a strict contraindication to taking something like BPC-157, especially for a long period of time. However, that doesn't mean they have to like prophylactically start VEGF inhibitors, because you want a balance between these things. So that being said, I think it would be difficult, even if you tried to avoid omega-6s and seed oils and tried to consume a whole bunch of omega-3s and also tried to limit your calories, I still think it would be difficult to skew your ratio of omegas to too many omega-3s without enough omega-6s.
Like to actually try to induce like an omega-6 deficiency.
Yes.
That would be quite a task in our food environment.
Yes. And with our current American diet, I do agree with the line of thinking that says our diet in general has way too many processed foods, not enough fibers, just like the authors would agree. And this should be a primary target for preventing colorectal cancer.
Yeah. Psyllium husk bag in every home. That's my Make America Healthy Again platform.
That's hilarious. little devil's advocate poke holes in that too, but I am a psyllium husk enthusiast, as I know Dom D'Agostino is too, who's also at USF.
If you want to poke holes in it, you just say, well, look at all these cases of like bowel impaction or paralytic, you know, impaction and constipation and all these surgeries and things that people have to go into the ER for from taking psyllium husk. It's like, yeah, just like anything, the dose makes the poison. If you take the whole bag at once, you're going to have a bad time.
Yeah. Should we ban canola oil? Is that super high in omega-6s with no omega-3?
Banning canola oil for frying French fries? We should just ban frying foods. Canola oil for salad dressing? Totally okay. I mean, if you're trying to make the case that like frying things in different oils makes it a healthy food, I think that's sort of the wrong, you're chasing the wrong approach to population health. Like, I don't think anyone believes that French fries in, say,
tallow
are a superfood that is nutritionally dense and good for you. Whereas if those same fries are fried in soybean oil, which has a higher, let's use canola oil. It's lower smoke points, so more inflammatory.
More oxidation.
You're not going to see a big difference in somebody's health picture from tallow fries versus canola fries.
Mm-hmm.
Soybean might be the best of all those.
Yeah, it very well might be. That being said, what's worse, soybean oil in your salad dressing or in the French fries? Even Chick-fil-A has soybean oil in their salad dressing.
They also have soybean oil in their Chick-fil-A sauce. First two ingredients, sugar and soybean oil. It's pretty bad stuff, but it's delicious. Yeah, it's the not the soybean oil. There's not an answer to that question. It's sort of like a trick question.
Yeah.
You ask somebody like, hey, is the soybean oil in this worse or this? I really don't think it's that more inflammatory after, and you can make a case of like, what if it's been in the fryer for 5 years? Sure, maybe it breaks down and gets a little bit more oxidized. Mm-hmm. But say it's the first fry of the day, of that oil's life ever, and it's the same amount of oil you're ingesting in the salad, and at the end of the day, all your other things balance out, I don't think you're going to see a difference.
I can eat way more French fries than salad.
And that's the answer, right? It's the salad that's the difference.
But yeah,
compared to the French fries.
By the way, I should probably say when I said even Chick-fil-A, I was sarcastic. I'm like, you know, people see Chick-fil-A like better. Like Chick-fil-A is kind of like fast food. I just happen to like, you know, sometimes I like to get the biggest grilled nugget possible, but even their grilled nuggets are not perfect. So, you know, you have to have food flexibility just somehow. I just figured if I said even Chick-fil-A, I didn't want people to think that I was putting them on a pedestal of like health.
Dr. Gillette says eating at Chick-fil-A, it is impossible to gain weight.
The gold standard of health. Anyways, another thing is we discussed the different pro-resolving mediator supplements. And, you know, of course, there's ways to get the same benefit from your diet, namely the omega-3 to omega-6 ratio. The studies on this, I don't see that they're going to be any easier than when we were studying antioxidants like resveratrol, or is the anthocyanins better, like even a polyphenol blend, which are popular.
Yeah, I mean, with our current state, like the speed at which the science happens, I mean, unless you by sort of dumb luck land on the perfect pro-resolving mediator, then it's just going to be a process of elimination. Or maybe these are things that get, like, you know, packaged in exosomes for better bioavailability. Mm-hmm. Maybe these are things that, like, you're looking at, like, how do we give somebody, like, booster shot to make this switch happen? And then you kill mm-hmm. it with some sort of antibiotic or some sort of light thing, like a short-term thing to, like, okay, let's kickstart this person into this anti-inflammatory state.
Yeah.
So they can actually heal. But this is, like, just sort of guessing and forecasting, like, what is the future of medicine going to look like? And I don't think, like, we're on the cusp of this today, unless it's just by, like I said, dumb luck.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. As always, even if it's a supplement, like several of the ones recommended in the article, think about the benefit and the detriment. A lot of them have low downside other than pill fatigue. And then also think about the other takeaways that you can have regarding, you know, should you demonize something like a seed oil? Is it really the problem that we can overconsume them? Or is it that switch or multiple switches that we talked about? For example, TNF-alpha, is that really more of the problem why things are getting backlogged?
Yeah, like, is a TNF-alpha inhibitor going to solve the problems that excess calories cause? Probably not.
Yeah. If only there was a pill that helped people regularly diet and exercise regardless of the happenings in their life.
There is. It's called the Gillette Health Podcast.
Yeah.
And in that theme, thank you for watching.
I wish so.
thank you for your time. Please let us know in the comments what we did well, what we did not so well, why we're wrong about seed oils still. And may God bless you with health and happiness.
Save big this holiday season. All in the Kroger app. Buy two, get three free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up. Then get a flavorful Kroger spiral sliced ham for 89 cents a pound with an additional $25 purchase. Limit two, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.